It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. I wish I was in the garden of environmental campaigner George Monbiot, but George's new plot is a building site. More of this later. George has been a Guardian columnist since 96 and has written several books, a few of which have received big awards. He has been accused of being a scaremonger and alarmist, but it turns out he has not been scaremongering enough. I think most now agree there is a planetary emergency. George, thank you so much for agreeing to come on. And can I just start with your name? So it is pronounced Monbiot, is it?
That's right, yes. And it's a bit of a mystery, even to our own family. There's only 13 of us in the world, and we're all closely related to each other. We don't have six fingers on the left hand, but no one knows exactly where it comes from. For a while, because I've got some West African ancestry, we thought it might be a Bantu name, which acquired a silent T as our ancestors moved through France, but that doesn't seem to stack up. So yeah, it's an open question.
But your mother apparently, so your father's French and your mother found it very difficult to pronounce and she called him Wombat. Is that correct?
Actually, that's the first time I've heard that. It's quite possible. I'm prepared to believe it.
George, the start of your interest, the story goes, that as a child you saw a man cutting down a tree which had woodpeckers in it, and you asked the man why, and then you guarded it so he couldn't remove the woodpeckers home. But then you realised you're going to be told off for being late for lunch, so you left, and obviously we can guess the rest. Yeah. But is that right? Is that what you think triggered your interest in the environment?
Well, the interest was there already, which was why I tried to defend this tree. We lived on the edge of a common, which was actually a rewilding golf course. Of course, the word rewilding hadn't even been coined then, but it had been a golf course. It had been abandoned, and this wonderful habitats had started encroaching back onto it. There were some ancient woods. There were various meadows, which just got richer and richer. There was heathland, gorse, adders and lizards and all that. It was a fantastic playground for all of us kids in the village. And it's one of the things that triggered and reinforced my great interest in the natural world. And one day I was watching this green woodpecker's nest in a dead cherry tree. There were quite a few of these big old wild cherries growing on the common. And this guy turns up with a chainsaw, and he had rights of estivus on the common, which, in other words, that allowed him to take dead wood. And in those days, I don't think there were any rules saying when you could cut it down. And it seemed to me just utterly outrageous that he intended to cut down this tree with a nest of unfledged green woodpeckers in it. It was just, like, to me, just so grotesque and obviously wrong. And so I, without being aware that anyone had ever done such a thing in history before, I hugged the tree. I was a tree hugger at the age of eight. And I clung onto this tree, and he thought I was mad. I mean, he was a local guy who, you know, just that's what he'd done all his life. He'd cut down trees and sold them for firewood. And so, you know, there was this standoff. He wasn't aggressive or anything. He just thought I was completely bonkers. And anyway, he just then got on with picking up a few sort of bits of dead wood around the place. And then I felt this sort of time's winged chariot hurrying near, you know, the ticking of the clock. The one rule I had, I could go out all day long. I was totally free. It was wonderful in that respect. I could roam around, make camps with my friends. We had our rival gangs. We climbed trees. We dug for bottles. There were all these old bottle dumps on the common, Victorian bottles. We looked for flints. We watched wildlife, all of that. The one rule was that I had to come back for lunch. And so, as you say, I went home for lunch with predictable results, and I learned two very important lessons from that. One, don't go home for lunch. And two, what is destroying the living planet and our prospects more than anything else is obedience. If we do what we're told, things go badly wrong.
Oh, good lessons there. So you went off to prep school as a child, then to Stowe, and then you got an open scholarship to Brasenose in Oxford. But you had an unhappy time at university, and you even regret having gone to Oxford, even though the zoology course you took you thought was excellent. But you say the culture didn't really suit you, and when you tried to join in, you fell flat on your face, sometimes in a drunken stupor. So you're not a party animal. You felt a bit of a misfit.
I pushed myself into being a party animal, and I thought I could be part of the fast crowd and join in this very enticing high society there. It was a very exciting place to be, and there were all these super cool, interesting, exciting people, and I thought, I want to be like them, and I want to be part of their gang. And it just was so wrong for me. It just went against the whole grain of my nature. And so I had a bit of a mental health crisis in the second year. I just kind of fell apart because I've been living in the wrong skin. You know, I've been so opposed to all the things that make my life worthwhile and that I love. You know, I'd gone in almost the opposite direction. And it was horrible, but it was quite salutary at the same time, because it cured me of ever wanting that again, of ever wanting to be in the fast lane, to be living the high life, to be drinking lots, to be having what is supposed to be fun, drugs and sex and rock and roll and all that. And actually, it really isn't fun. It just trashes your mind and your sense of well-being.
Oh, that's fascinating. But your sister, Catherine, fared even worse, wasn't she? She was brutally bullied at school, I think, was that right? Mm. And then that led to suffering from anorexia, and she died really quite young. So it's these pressures to conform and be the norm. And if you're not, you're odd. But actually, I think now we're all starting to celebrate differentness in us all, aren't we? Because it's so boring when you're one of the crowd. And yeah, to stand out, whether it's you've got the red hair of Sandra Rhodes or whatever, or be quite different, is fantastic. To have the nerve to do that, to be yourself, is quite a thing.
It is. And I'm so glad you pick up on this, because finding the self-confidence to actually be the person you really are and you want to be, while at the same time, obviously, being responsive to other people. I mean, you can't just say, well, you know, my inherent nature is a brutal dictator, so that's what I'm going to be. You have all the time to be empathetic and engaged and to listen and to respond. But within that constraint, to find your groove and to be self-confident in following that groove, that was so much more difficult in the past. Obviously, there are new forms of social conformity now. You know, there are new ways in which you can't dissent, and some of those are negative. Some are positive. You know, we should all be respectful to each other. You know, and we shouldn't be racist, and we shouldn't be sexist, and we shouldn't be against people just because they've chosen a different way of being and a different way of living. Absolutely. But sometimes there are new conformities which can limit our minds. But by and large, I think as a general rule, we are freer now to be the people we want to be. It's easier to follow that groove, and that's something we should celebrate.
Yeah, absolutely. You didn't have a great relationship with your father. He was a great businessman. He was very conservative, but he was progressive, wasn't he, on social matters? He was known to judge people, as I understand it, purely on their abilities and not on their background and standing. And he said, apparently, I was reading his obituary, people asked me, this George Monbiot, is he any relation of yours? I say, yes, I'm his father. And they said, I'm so sorry. We all have difficult children. And then he replied, which I thought was lovely. I don't think George is difficult. He absolutely believes in what he is doing, which I like. And I just thought that was so nice. So you were acceptive. He was acceptive of what you were going for.
Yes. I mean, we disagreed profoundly on a lot of things, but something which I think was quite remarkable about him, for a man of his generation, his class, his politics, was that I never once heard a sexist, racist or homophobic thing come from his mouth, which was quite amazing. I mean, there were lots of things he said which I found absolutely outrageous and was pretty horrified by, but never those things. He was very accepting of people. And was never prejudiced towards people because of who they were and where they'd come from. I mean, his politics, you know, I felt pointed towards a very harsh and brutal society, and one without kindness, one where the devil takes the hindmost. And unfortunately, you know, some of his ways of being as a parent and as a corporate manager reflected that also, but you know, he was unusual in not suffering those common prejudices.
And you say that you spent the last 2 years of your Oxford time planning your escape, and you say I was diabolical at organisation, but you're good at writing and speaking. But now you're organising the world to come to, you know, terms with what we're doing to the planet. So you've got to improve those skills, and you must be good at organising now, because you have made huge waves. So that must come through organisation, mustn't it, really?
Yes, I suppose, you know, my partner does point this out, that, you know, when I want to be, I can be very organised.
Yes.
But there are huge sort of gaps, enormous gaps in my life organisation. I mean, I say that all the organisational genes went to my surviving sister, Eleanor, who's brilliant. You know, she's just really together, and everything she wants to have happen happens. And she's really fantastic, an admirable, remarkable person. But yes, I mean, I'm quite good at organising my working life. But if I'm asked to manage anyone, if I'm asked to arrange anything which involves a large number of people, I find it very hard to focus on that. I find it very easy to focus on my research, the huge amount of reading I do, of organising that research, of bringing out what's interesting, of trying then to summarise it in ways that people can understand easily. Because that fascinates me and grips me, I can organise myself quite well around that. But anything to do with management, and I'm involved at the moment in building an organisation, and I feel so timid about it, because I don't have any of those necessary skills.
Perhaps you should take up delegation, George, dare I say.
Oh, I do. One thing I'm very good at is delegation, and I'm totally blessed with my fantastic assistant, Fee. I mean, I call it delegation. It's actually neglect. She does all the things which I really should be doing. But you know, without her, I would be completely lost.
You realised at university that the only job you wanted, which didn't exist, was to make an investigative environmental programmes for the BBC. And after hammering on its doors for a year, you received a call from the head of BBC's Natural History Unit during your final exams. And he said, "You're so effing persistent, you've got the job." I love that. That's one way to get in there.
yes. John Sparks, he was this wonderful guy. He was a rather sort of bluff bloke, and so slightly formidable, but very frank. And he just said, right, this guy obviously wants it bad enough. Whatever happens, he's going to work. And of course, you know, having got the job, I landed this job as a radio producer at the Natural History Unit, and I didn't really know anything. You know, I didn't even know how magnetic tape worked. And so I had to, the first program I had to make, which was just, you know, a couple of weeks after I joined, I went into the office on Monday morning and I left the office on Thursday evening. I just worked right through without sleeping. And by the time I left on Thursday evening, I knew more or less how to make a program. Just massive effort.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's impressive. But we've got a problem, haven't we? I mean, everybody encourages us to consume. We live to consume. It's the human condition. We've never got enough. And even though all the happiness studies say that, you know, beyond a certain amount of wealth, you are no happier, even if you've got zillions. No one really believes that, do they? So what advertising, social media, everything, the government, they'll be kicked out if the economy doesn't keep on growing. We'll kick them out. We all think we're going to live like kings. So and really, the warm feeling that we might get that our grandchildren are going to inherit a nice, livable planet is nothing compared to the fact that we want this brand new car on the forecourt. We want, you know, to eat caviar every day. What? How are you going to stop this basic human condition of I want it and I want it now?
Well, I'm so glad you asked this. Thanks, but you see, I don't think it is a basic human condition.
Really?
My father-in-law, who is a remarkable man, he died a couple of years ago, Tony Wrigley. He became an economic historian, very eminent in his field. And one of the things that triggered that interest was that he was evacuated during the war. He was brought up in the docks in Liverpool, and he was evacuated to North Wales. And he and his brother, they were 8 and 6, lived with this single woman in this tiny little village. And she had a cottage with no electricity, no running water, not even glass in the windows, just wooden shutters. And she had no material aspirations at all. All her aspirations were to do with chapel and community. That was where all her ambitions and her life focus were. And he realized that there were quite a few people like that. This was people's moral universe, that they their growth that they sought was a spiritual growth or a social growth, but it wasn't consumer growth. It wasn't wanting more stuff. And one of the extraordinary changes in that period since the Second World War is that we've been turned from citizens to consumers, and we've been bombarded with propaganda saying your life is not complete unless you got this and that and the other, unless you're getting more and more every year, unless you focus all your aspirations and ambitions on material prosperity rather than, say, social prosperity or spiritual prosperity or environmental prosperity. And yet, you know, we should have glass in our windows, and we should have electricity, and we should have running water. You know, these, I think, are basic needs. And we should aspire to have those basic needs. But, you know, no one needs a yacht. No one needs a Maserati. No one needs a second home. You know, all of these things that we're taught to aspire to, that is what's trashing the living planet. And it's those unmet desires. And of course, they will always be unmet because, as we see from a huge range of psychological studies, if you're bombarded by advertising and marketing all day, every day, as we are, then you can never feel a sense of satisfaction and a sense of arrival. But it's those unmet desires which are essentially corrupting, because they mean that you've got that vulnerability, and someone can always say to you, "Well, if you do this for me, you know, you can get some more money and you can afford this new thing." And, you know, you see in politics, I mean, like Starmer with the clothes, it's just so ridiculous. I mean, for God's sake, why can't you buy your own clothes? You know, you can go on Vinted and you can buy anything you want secondhand for almost nothing. The most amazing clothes, you know, if you're not causing any environmental impact because they've already been bought and sold, they're out there. Why do you need someone else to get? Because you've got no cap to your aspirations, because there's no end to your desires. And somehow, despite this bombardment of propaganda, we have to bring our minds into a place where we limit our desires, where we shed those unmet needs.
You say that, but that is a massive turnaround. I mean, I was working for the guy who is a food scientist who has a massive corporation, and his firm's job is to persuade us to buy all these new inventions with artificial sweeteners and everything. And he says it's actually not, we don't buy it according to food taste, how we like it. We buy it because the marketing tells us it's cool. It's going to be this, that and the other. And I said to him, well, how do you switch that? You know, if you were working for the other side, the anti all these ingredients and the, to promote natural food, how would you persuade people to do this? And he said, well, I would approach it from the fact of delayed gratification. So if you don't eat this bar stuffed with calories, artificial ingredients, sweeteners, etc., in a few hours' time, you'll feel much better as a result of it. But that is a hard sell. And it's the same with consumerism. And you're against the likes of Amazon and the equivalents in Russia and China. You know, I can press this button here and I can get virtually anything for the cost of very little. And I got that instant hit, you know. And because of globalization, the reduced cost of manufacture, you know, the whole communities that have been producing things in the past 100 years have sort of gone, haven't they? And everything's homogenized. So it's that convincing us, George, that you're right and that we're wrong to want these things that I think is, I don't know how you do it. I despair.
The first thing I think to recognize, Bunny, is, you know, you call it a huge shift that we would need, and absolutely you're right, but there's already been a huge shift. You know, the reason we are where we are is that within the course of two or three generations, there's been this massive psychological shift, this massive economic shift, this massive social shift, which has brought us to where we are. We have been quite deliberately pushed into a different way of being very successfully by a highly efficient marketing industry. And that's dire. But the hopeful aspect of that is that if we can be pushed that far, that fast in one direction, we can move that far, that fast in another direction. You know, we always have this assumption that society is set in stone, that this is the way things are and will always be. And they can't change. You can't change the system. And yet what we've seen is massive systemic change. Everything has changed. Who can tell you, oh, you can't change human nature? Our nature has been hugely changed by that shift from being social citizens to being seeing ourselves as consumers. We can change it in another direction. And I'm not saying we go back, you know, there's no future in going back. You know, we have to find a different way. And one way that I put it, what we should be looking for is what I call private sufficiency, public luxury. And the argument here.
Sorry, private sufficiency.
Private sufficiency, public luxury. So you know, if everyone, I mean, for a start, you know, it's never going to happen. You know, we're always told we're all temporarily embarrassed millionaires, which is why we subscribe to this system. But we're never all going to have a yacht. We're never all going to have a Lamborghini. We're never all going to have endless super homes and private islands, because that's not how the system works. Some people are supremely rich because they're exploiting the labor of other people. And those people have to remain poor for them to be so rich. So it's never going to happen. But if it did happen, what would the consequence be? Well, that would be the end of everything. You know, the environmental footprint of billionaires is thousands of times greater than that of average citizens. And we would cook the planet in a matter of hours if we all had our yacht and our private plane and the rest of it. And so there isn't the space, there isn't even the physical space for everyone to aspire to private luxury. I mean, you know, if we all had our own, if people in London each had their own tennis court and swimming pool and art collection, London would cover all of England. Where would everyone else live? You know, you just can't do it. The maths don't work. But we can all aspire to public luxury, magnificent public swimming pools and public tennis courts and public parks and other amazing things that we can build together, and that far from excluding people, actually create more resources for people to enjoy. And because there might be thousands of people enjoying the same thing, the environmental cost and the space that it takes up is much, much less than if everyone's trying to have it privately. I mean, classic example, here in my village, in South Devon, where I live, there's been an appeal to restore the swimming pool at the community centre, going on for what, it must be 5 years or something now. That swimming pool is still empty because we can't raise enough money to get the swimming pool repaired and built. And yet all around there are second homes with private swimming pools in where people have no difficulty at all in not only maintaining those swimming pools, but heating them all through the year, even though they're not there most of the time. It's so outrageous. That is a misallocation of wealth on a phenomenal scale. You know, so one person can have a swimming pool which they never use, whereas hundreds and hundreds of people could use this swimming pool if we could only raise enough money to get it functioning again. But the people who need it most are the ones who've got the least money. And so it's, you know, something is very badly wrong here. And what I feel, you know, this answer, private sufficiency, public luxury, means, you know, we should each have our own domain. You know, we should each have a decent home where we've got our own basic needs are met within that home, you know, and I'm not saying we sweep away all private property, not at all. But if we want to spread our wings and enjoy luxury, let's do that together rather than separately, because that the planet can afford. But private luxury for everyone, even if it were conceivable, the planet could not afford.
Yeah, a very good point there. You say you are a media tart, and that is requisite of your job, isn't it? You've got to do that.
Yes.
To get everyone to hear. Yeah.
I mean, I can't say I enjoy that aspect. I mean, I'm really enjoying talking to you, partly because you've obviously really dug into this, so to speak, and done the research and asking such pertinent and penetrating questions. It's fantastic. But I mean, I don't get interviewed much on the BBC or elsewhere, but if I do, it's often a really dispiriting experience because they never get below a certain level. You know, it's very, very superficial, and the big questions don't get asked. But here you are asking the big questions, so thank you.
I am actually quite amazed that you're still alive, because when I flick back through what you've done, you know, when you've been writing your various books and things in Indonesia, where they were forcing migration, and moving hundreds of thousands of people out from the inner islands to the outer islands. You say at one point you had to walk and canoe for 4 weeks from the central highlands to the coast. We became lost in the forest for several days and ate insects and rats to stay alive. And you're almost stung to death by hornets. But there were several incidents like this. And I thought, my God, he's alive. You know, he's still alive.
Yes.
So you have suffered immense hardships in pursuing items, things that you thought were so wrong and needed to be exposed. You have, haven't you? Massively so. Which is your worst, most terrifying incidents ever, where you really never thought you'd get out alive?
Yeah, good question. I was beaten up in northeastern Brazil and very nearly killed by military police and these freelance gunmen, these pistoleiros there. In fact, my death was reported in the Folha de São Paulo and very nearly reported in the Guardian, but through an utterly bizarre coincidence, I ended up talking on the phone to the Guardian reporter, who this was long before I worked for the Guardian, who was researching the story. And she said, yes, I've heard about this British journalist. He's been murdered in northeastern Brazil. I said, oh, that's terrible. I said, I didn't even know there was another British journalist working in that area. And she said, yeah, no, he was found garrotted behind the police station. It's really, he was beaten up and then he was garrotted and his body's been found. I said, that's awful. I said, what was he doing there? Oh, investigating land theft. I said, that's amazing. That's exactly what I was doing. And she said, and you didn't come across him? I said, no, I didn't. I didn't meet this guy. What was his name? She said, George Monbiot something. I said, ah, I hate to spoil your story.
Oh, that's a better ending, though, isn't it? A much, yes, much better ending. Yeah. But also, you contracted cerebral malaria and you didn't recognise it, and you nearly died in Lodwar, was it, District Hospital?
Lodwar District Hospital, yes, in northeastern Kenya. You're probably right. That was probably the nastiest of the experiences. So I was, at one point in my notes, I was dead. I was written down as clinically dead. When I came to, and actually I found the whole set of experiences extremely distressing, and it took me a long time to be able to talk about it. I found myself staring into someone's eyes. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know what I was doing. And all I could see was this guy just looking straight into my eyes from about 4 inches away. And slowly those eyes filmed over and then they closed and the guy had died. And what it was that the hospital was so crowded that our beds had been pushed together. And so I'd been pushed his bed had been pushed against mine. So there were two beds together all the way and just the corridor on the far side of each bed. And this guy on the next bed was dying of AIDS and he just died in front of my eyes. That was the first thing I saw when I came round. Yeah. And when some days later I was able to sit up, it was like I could see just this vision of hell, these people with massive open wounds, with limbs broken and it was just screaming out in pain. It was, this massively under-resourced, desperate hospital. Who were brilliant, they saved my life, but there was, one nurse for this huge ward, one doctor for several wards, and they were overstretched and underpaid. And I had no idea what had happened because I just, when I collapsed with malaria, I just completely blacked out. Then, either because of that, or because of the drugs, I had intravenous chloroquine and other drugs to try to bring me back. For several days after that, I just went into full on, well, I now recognize it as paranoid schizophrenia for about 4 days. And I was seeing things, hearing voices, in fact, the whole range of sensations, all my senses were hallucinating effectively. I mean, I was in an earthquake. I felt it. I felt the tremors. The ground was moving up and down. I heard the slates falling off the roof, people screaming, everything you would experience in an earthquake, but there was no earthquake. And it was an absolutely terrifying time. And I heard voices and they were telling me to kill myself. And so ever since then, luckily there was no recurrence of that. It just was for 4 days and then it stopped. Ever since then, I've had some inkling of what it must be to have a paranoid schizophrenia or any other of these terrifying mental health conditions. I mean, what you have to live with is just off the scale.
Yeah. And it took you about a year to recover from that experience. Yes. It's really horrendous.
What happened after, I mean, I lost 2 stone or more in weight and every tiny bug that came along would knock me down. Up till then I'd been very resistant to illness. Yeah. I've been very lucky, but I just was super susceptible. And so of course, trying to work in very difficult circumstances in East Africa just became almost impossible. And I just about scraped through to the end of the research I was doing for a book. And then I came home and thought, that's me done, basically. I can't, I'd spent 6 years working in the tropics and I just, it's going to be a long time before I'm strong enough to do that again.
Yeah. But in 95, you did receive a UN Global 500 award, which was given to you by Nelson Mandela. And then you co-presented a film with Greta Thunberg called Nature Now, which has been watched 60 million times. So, you are making big waves. Your media tartishness is getting there, hopefully. George, you've got this exciting new project. You're renovating a house in Devon. So are you going to be off grid?
No, it doesn't make any sense to be off-grid if you've already got a grid connection. Off-grid is really hard work. And that's because you have to balance your electricity supply and demand within your own home, which is a really difficult thing to do. I mean, the beauty of the national grid is you've got the potential for balancing across that grid. Even better if it's an international grid, as we've got with international connectors going to other countries, because then you can balance renewable sources against each other. Generally speaking, the wider the geographical range of your electricity supplies, the easier it is to balance them. So we'll generate as much electricity as we can, but that won't be exactly the same electricity that we use.
Right. And so what innovative things are you doing that we should all perhaps be thinking about?
Well, I mean, we're going to try to climate proof it as much as possible while minimizing our labor at the same time. And one way that I've found very effective in the past that we'll be doing again is to put in a decent sized water tank, probably about 2,000 liters, taking water off the roof with a submersible pump in it, which then feeds directly into weepy hose in the polytunnel and a timer on the plug. Some people have timers on their water supply when they're using mains water. It makes no sense at all. It's much better to have timer on your electricity supply. And then you can just, without any leakage or anything, you can just set it to say it's going to come on 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes in the evening. You don't have to be there. The whole system looks after itself.
I'm always amazed in this country that more people don't have underground storage water, because in France it seems to me that they're everywhere. And generally in this country, when I work in Japan, they've been having permeable tarmac 30 years ago, they were using it. Whereas we all our tarmac seems to drain. Now it's a very new thing. My client, uses all the oil from his restaurant. It's converted to feed the tractors, and that's 20 years plus ago. And all the composting from his restaurants is reused and applied to the fields. They have big bins below the restaurant. We are very, very behind, aren't we?
We seem to take a perverse delight in getting things wrong and in not embracing new and better ways of doing things. And I'm afraid that is also the case within the environmental movement. There's a lot of neophobia in the environmental movement, people being really opposed to new technologies just because they are new. To give you one example, which I've seen a bit of around here, for example, here in the Lentil Belt in South Devon, that I know people who refuse to have a microwave oven in the house because they think it's going to kill them. There's absolutely zero evidence that a microwave oven will harm you. But they do have a wood-burning stove, and there's a great deal of evidence that that will harm you because of the indoor pollution that it causes. But wood-burning stove is an old technology, whereas a microwave is newer, and so we don't like the microwave.
But I do think it's confusing. With my car, so I've got a little old diesel Golf, and it's running, just running now, I think, because it's got 100,000 miles on the clock. But if I changed it to something more environmentally efficient, the whole business of a new car, you see, I don't know how it stacks up. Am I mad to be keeping to this old banger that's very reliable, or should I invest at a fortune, small fortune, and get a new electric car?
Well, the obvious answer to that is that if you're going to get a new car, get a second-hand one, because then you haven't commissioned the construction of that car, and you can't be blamed for the embodied emissions. And the thing is that we're absolutely surrounded by waste, by things made, used, and discarded within a very short amount of time. And so it's extremely easy to live while using primarily secondhand things. I mean, all the clothes I wear, except I hasten to say my underwear, are secondhand. And it's so simple now. You can get every I mean, I'm not a great clothes person, but you can get whatever you want, whatever you picture you have in your mind, you can buy it somewhere secondhand very easily indeed. Why not? And in doing that, you greatly reduce your environmental impact.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you on that, except I beat you in that I also, with my underwear, my daughter saw me
You'll be able to buy more.
quite recently and she
You
said,
put me
"Mummy,
to shame.
I threw those knickers out 10 years ago." 20 years ago, she just corrected me. But I have no qualms in that direction at all. But I do think that just being gardeners, we are quite good. I mean, Peter Harper, who was head of research at CAT, the Centre for Alternative Technology, he spent 10 years researching inputs and concluded that recreational gardens are brilliant. They keep you at home, and this outweighs all the other things you can do that stop you going out and spending money. To an extent, then, I feel that at least being a gardener, we are doing something.
It's a very good point that Peter makes, and it's a really useful comparison because, you know, we all need our hobbies. You know, I think we fall apart without hobbies. They're absolutely essential to our well-being. Otherwise, we get overwhelmed with stress, with anxiety, you know, because of our work, because of the state of the planet, because of all the other things which are coming at us all the time. And you just need that headspace. And for me, you know, I don't get it from yoga or meditation or anything. That doesn't work for me at all. I need to be doing something with my hands. And if I'm doing something with my hands, I get into a really nice space where I'm not thinking about anything else, or at least not in a bad way. I'm just sort of blissfully engaged in the task at hand. Yeah. And gardening gives you that to a great extent. It also sort of pulls you forward into the future. You're constantly thinking, what, you know, how's this plant going to grow? What fruit might I be getting from it? How's it going to flower? You're always thinking about the future in a positive way, which is a very, very important thing for our mental health.
Yeah.
So that's a really good metric that Peter uses. And it's a very good counterweight to a slightly more depressing finding, which was a recent paper showing that on average, growing your own vegetables can cause 6 times the carbon emissions of buying them from a professional grower. And the reason for that is that because you're doing it at a smaller scale, you have to bring in all your own infrastructure to do it in your own garden. So for instance, you know, I'm going to have this water tank with a submersible pump. And, you know, that in the long run, the fact that I'm not using any piped water, you know, might compensate for that. I don't really know. I've had to put in my own polytunnel, and, you know, putting in a small polytunnel is probably less efficient in carbon terms than putting in a very big one, which needs fewer footings. I don't know, but, you know, it's got steel hoops, it's got plastic. One thing I've been very careful to do is to absolutely minimize the materials needed. So for instance, I did the whole thing with just 2 bags of cement and no bought in ballast at all. I made my own aggregate by smashing up the rubble that I found in the garden. It was very time consuming, a lot of hitting things with hammers, but I was very proud that I didn't actually buy any ballast at all. And then I mixed it as postcrete to have the minimum amount of cement, put in a load of lumps of rubble to give it that extra weight. And it's great. It works really well. I'm trying to push against that metric and absolutely minimize the amount of carbon emissions and materials that I use in growing my own veg, and try and bring it closer to the extremely efficient way in which it's grown commercially in terms of its emissions.
Yeah, it was shocking when I read that. It came out about a year ago or so, didn't it? I think. And I remember being, how can that be so? But I also, when I think I've been doing it for 50 years, hopefully, you know, that means it's more sustainable, and that's 6 times less efficient must be more even, I would have thought.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that's true. You know, if you build your infrastructure right so that it's really going to last, and you invest in high quality stuff, then that's going to tail away over the years, your environmental impact. And eventually you might well be doing better than commercial horticulture in terms of that impact.
I hope so. I remember when I interviewed you years ago for the Telegraph, you said in your 2.5 hours a week, you can produce more veg than you could eat. So describe your new plot. What have you got? You mentioned a polytunnel. So you've put in a polytunnel?
Yeah, we had a polytunnel raising party and we had about 20 people involved in that. It was lovely. I got some secondhand staff planks and put in raised beds. All the soil and compost came from the plot. We found about 25 years accumulation of compost. So the very first thing I did when we arrived was to build an enormous compost heap, really huge. It's about 3 meters long and about 1.5 meters deep, 1.5 meters tall, divided into 2 sections, one smaller, obviously, for the mature compost, and one bigger for all the green material to dump in it. And because we got quite a lot of trees and other vegetation on the land, there's always going to be more stuff to put in. So I've had to more or less build that soil from scratch, because where we got our veg beds, it was all subsoil dug out when they built the house. And so they just sort of built this platform, which is nice. It's a nice, fairly flat area for growing. But there was nothing on it. It was just a sort of rubble of stone. It's got quite a high clay content, which is great, but a bit of sand and shingly small slate in it. And so on top of that, I layered, first of all, our highest quality. Well, first of all, I dug up some of the subsoil, broke it up, allow the roots to get in, put our highest quality compost on directly on top of that, then some good soil, then some slightly lower quality compost on the top. And so starting the process of building soil, and we're seeing a lot more earthworms and other species coming in now. And the beds have worked really well. Even in the first year, we've had very productive growing season, partly because, of course, you get a slug holiday in that first year. You know, everyone starts a garden and think, oh, we don't have slugs here. Isn't that fantastic? Finally, I've moved to a place without slugs. But all it is that the slugs haven't found you yet. So, you know, they're already now, we can just see them starting to close in. Oh. But it's been very easy this year because we haven't had to bother with them.
I was talking to Sandra Rhodes in her garden this week, and she said she had slugs up on her garden, which is 9 floors up in London.
God, how is that possible?
That's what we wondered, but they were eating her hostas. I think it could be, you know, birds and things. I remember my dad, he built a pool, a sort of wildlife pool in his garden, and within a short period of time, he had big carp swimming in them, having not brought them in, but the eggs came in on duck's feet. So
that's because fish eggs are adapted to be sticky for that very purpose. But slug eggs aren't sticky. They're underground, so I don't know how they would attach themselves to birds' feet.
You think it came up in the compost or something? I don't know.
God knows. I mean, maybe they've learned to fly.
I have seen snails on our bedroom ceiling, dare I say it. And, you know, it's not particularly damp.
I'm getting a picture of this. This amazingly tough person.
It's exciting. So describe your garden, because I'm fascinated, because your partner or wife, Rebecca Wrigley, is chief executive of Rewilding Britain. So I'm thinking, you know, you're going to have your vegetables, you've got your polytunnel. What else? How are you going to design your garden so it's good environmentally, so you enjoy it?
So we're both mad about nature and mad about veg growing, and fruit growing for that matter. So we're trying to combine these two things, you know, grow as much of our fruit and veg as we can, while at the same time having wild areas. We're very lucky because, I mean, it's only a small garden. It's only about a fifth or a sixth of an acre or so, but the previous owners put in a beautiful perennial wildflower meadow. There's some really nice mature trees, and it borders a piece of council land which is completely rewilded, and it's a really lovely woodland, beautiful woodland, right at the bottom of the garden, because it's on a very steep slope going on the side of a valley. Right at the bottom is a little stream, which is a tributary of the River Dart. And it's a great wildlife corridor because it connects to, well, the Dart at one end and loads of woodland and interesting places at the other end. I went down with a friend the other day who happens to be a mammal expert, Hugh Warwick, and he said, "What's that?" And we looked, it was an otter moving up this little stream, probably dispersing because they use small streams as roads. And so it's just this sense that we're already in a really beautiful wild place, and we've got to protect that and preserve that and enhance it where we can, while at the same time enjoying it for all the other purposes that you use a garden. And I think, you know, our design is going to fit all that in somehow.
Mm. Fascinating, because I mean, it's interesting when you think about, say, planting trees, because Tony Kirkham, who ran trees at Kew, reckons in 2050 we'll have temperatures that Barcelona is having now. So trees that we plant in our gardens will have to withstand those conditions. And he reckons that already, you know, some of the pioneers like birch, rowan, malus, the shorter lived trees, are finding it quite tough. They're suffering from the temperature extremes. So we've really got to think maybe beyond native. You know, he's encouraging cork oaks and holm oaks and all this sort of thing, and some of the North American species like tulip trees, which I imagine that you think in your native landscape, you're thinking, not great.
It is a difficult one, isn't it? Because we know that some of our native trees support far more species than trees from elsewhere. You know, oaks and birch, for example, are fantastic reservoirs, are huge numbers of species. But, you know, they are in trouble, there's no question, not least because on top of climate breakdown, we seem determined to introduce every native tree in Britain to its most deadly pathogen. We'll somehow bring in the most awful tree diseases from every part of the world. We could, as an island, have really strong phytosanitary controls and ensure that we protect our trees, but somehow we just refuse to do that. And
we have just started doing those. But when I was working in Japan 20 odd years ago, I had to wash every plant I took there, had to be washed off all this compost. It was heavily checked, kept at the port until they'd agreed it. Whilst we, at that point, were just flooding the place with God knows what from God knows where, and didn't mind. I mean, we're slow.
Yeah, there's a very simple thing we could do, very simple rule, which is that if we're going to bring in any live plants from elsewhere, they have to be tissue cultured, but all other plants we produce here in our own country. And that would just eliminate the chances of introducing plant diseases. Until we do that, particularly, the post-Brexit checks regime has just collapsed. So whatever the rules say, you know, they're not going to be enforced. We're just going to kill our tree species one after another the way we're going, because we're not introducing effective rules or enforcing effective rules.
Mm. No, that is definitely a problem. But you say grow our own, you see. I said that because I buy trees regularly for clients that they produce quite beautifully grown trees in these air pots, and they supply lots of the gardens at Chelsea, because a lot of my older clients particularly want the instant tree. So I asked him, I said, why do you always import these from Holland, from Germany? And he said, because we're so small, our market is so small, we could not produce the variety of the sizes of everything to give people that choice. Whereas in Holland and Germany and Italy, they're supplying all of Europe and it's dead easy. Yeah. But we, because of the island thing, we can't. And that was his reason. So I don't think we would ever do that and keep the customer satisfied.
I mean, I understand what you're saying, but that's another aspect of the consumerism that we were talking about. You know, keeping the customer satisfied. Why should that be our primary aim? You know, keeping our ecosystems functioning, isn't that rather more important than keeping the customer satisfied? You know, I know this puts you in a difficult position, but my basic approach is, well, lump it. Sorry, you know, you can't have all your heart's desire. You can't have every single thing that you could possibly imagine. Here's something which is still blinking brilliant. It's a beautiful tree. You're going to absolutely love it. So just change your expectations a little bit.
Right. OK, George, lesson learned. I'll try that with my next client, the Arsewood. No, there are so many dilemmas everywhere, aren't there? That is the thing. And as a gardener, you know, we are hugely aware of the changes, more, I think, than most people. So a couple of days ago, my rain gauge said it was 15 gallons per square yard of soil. That was the rain we had. And luckily, we're on a hill. But down the road in Bedford, or, you know, a few miles away, they had floods and animals floating and disasters. And I can see it's going to be more and more of that. But anyway, are you going to rewild any of your garden as you are your partner? So you will do, when we say rewilding a garden, we can't, obviously, if you haven't got 3,000 acres, you have to manage it, don't you? Otherwise, you'd be swamped with probably a couple of sycamores and brambles, and that would
I mean, you can do things on a large scale that you can't do on a small scale. So you can't really expect to be able to do something really dramatic in wildlife terms. But we inherited a pond, which the people we bought the house from had put in. We've slightly profiled it to make it a bit more wildlife friendly. It's already lovely. It's got lots of dragonflies and frogs and newts, and it's beautiful. So we're happy about that. We've now planted a load of marginals around it, or sown a load of marginals to enhance that. And then we'll sort of spread out from the marginals into perennial wildflowers and then into woody shrubs. So yeah, we within our very limited space, we can definitely enhance it for wildlife. I mean, I would hesitate to call it rewilding when you're on such a small scale, because I tend to think of rewilding as being a large scale restoration of ecosystems, but enhancing its wildlife potential, making it more friendly for a wider range of species, that's definitely what we want to do.
Very much the Chris Baines approach, which he was advocating back in the 60s, I think. Yeah, no, I agree. And a pool, a natural pool, is one of the best things I think you can add, isn't it? It really is a source of water for many forms of life. And it's lovely. It really is calming. Thank you very much indeed. It's been fascinating talking to you. I would love to see your garden when it's done. I always like to bring my guest a present. And I've brought you, well, it's going to be sent to you shortly, as soon as they start lifting, a Cambridge gauge. And I think this is the sweetest, most beautiful fruit in the world. I've got one here. And Frank Matthews, who's given it to you, and he's one of the largest tree growers in the UK, has a massive range of extraordinary apples, pears, everything you can think of, and ornamental trees. And I've asked him for you to have a bare root one, because I think they're established much better and not too big. And they will deliver anywhere in the UK. So he'll send it to you. Or if you're ever near them in Worcestershire, they are well worth stopping off and having a look. But I hope it goes well. I don't know why you can't ever buy these in the shop, because I remember when we ate greengages at school, they were disgusting stew jobs and bitter. But these are literally delicious. Why can't we buy them commercially?
Well, first of all, thank you to you and to Frank for that. I really look forward. I love the Cambridge gauge. I've had one before on our allotment orchard in when we lived in Oxford. And they're fantastic. I think the best fruit you can eat anywhere in the world. The reason you can't get them in the shops is they don't travel. You take them 50 yards down the road and you've probably already turned them to mush, and they don't last. You know, they'll last a day or two, they'll be at their peak for literally about 24 hours, and you've got to eat them then. And that is the problem we face with so much of our fruit, like all the best pears, for instance. You will never be able to buy in the shops for the same reason. Apples have been selected to be as hard as rock. You can bounce them off the walls, and that's great for the retailers and for the wholesalers. That works very well, but not so much for us looking for texture and flavor and the rest of it. So sadly, if you're going to have the best fruit, you either have to grow your own or you have to know someone who does.
That's a very good point. And ours actually don't even get into the house. They're eaten from the moment, quickly. Lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bunny. It's been a great pleasure.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.